From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Amy Mann. One of her songs inspired filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson to make Magnolia. Several of her songs were on the soundtrack. One of them, Save Me, was nominated for an Academy Award. Now Mann has a new CD called Bachelor No. 2. Her own record company didn't think it was commercial enough to release, so she released it herself on the internet, and then she managed to get it into stores. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg has noticed a trend, corporations trying to change their image by changing their name. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson said today that disciplinary action will be taken in the loss of two computer hard drives that contained important nuclear secrets. The Energy Department confirmed yesterday that the hard drives were missing from a locked vault at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Investigators from the FBI and the Department of Energy have been unable to find the drives, but Richardson said today that intelligence officials don't believe that espionage is involved. Instead, he says it's more likely that the hard drives were lost or misplaced. The hard drives disappeared around the time the laboratory was largely evacuated during a major forest fire. President Clinton said today that he considers the security lapse very serious, but still has confidence in Secretary Richardson. A federal appeals court has agreed to hear Microsoft's appeal of a breakup order imposed on it for antitrust violations. Paul Whistle reports from member station KPLU in Seattle.
The acceptance of the case by the appeals court is seen as a victory for Microsoft. The government wanted the case to go directly to the Supreme Court, saying the case should be expedited so that consumers wouldn't have to wait too long for the benefits of competition to be restored. But the software company preferred to go through the Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, where it had won a previous ruling. In its appeal, Microsoft asked the court to put the breakup order on hold. Last week, Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson decided the company should be split in two, and he imposed restrictions on Microsoft's business conduct while it appeals the ruling. Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates has vehemently denied the company did anything wrong and says he's confident he'll win on appeal. He says splitting up Microsoft is unreasonable and would hurt consumers. For NPR News, I'm Paula Whistle in Seattle.
On Capitol Hill, Republicans are seizing on the issue of ballooning gasoline prices to attack the Clinton administration. They say the administration lacks a coherent energy policy. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The administration pressed OPEC to lift the cap on its production levels this spring. The cartel complied, but gasoline supplies continue to be tight. Prices are rising as high as $2 a gallon as the summer driving season kicks into gear. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, who favors drilling in sensitive areas such as Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, says the White House needs to address the problem.
What is their proposal? If not this, then what do they want to do? And if not now, what are they waiting for? Prices to go to $3 a gallon? For us to have another crisis where foreign oil is cut off and the American economy is put on its knees very quickly because we're so dependent on foreign oil. I'm trying to raise a red flag and say there's a problem here now.
Commodities markets concluded that OPEC isn't about to raise production again, and oil prices rose to three-month highs. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
In stocks, the Dow gained 58 points today to close at 10,622 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq gained 83 points. This is NPR News. Syria held funeral services for the late President Hafez Assad today, with hundreds of thousands of ordinary Syrians mourning in the streets. Assad's body lay in state in Damascus before being flown to his boyhood village in northwest Syria and placed in a mausoleum. Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations have resumed in the Washington, D.C. area as U.S. mediators step up their involvement in the talks. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Two sets of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations will occur simultaneously as the week progresses, one at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland and the other at Bowling Air Force Base in D.C. One set of talks will focus on the remaining obstacles to a final peace treaty, such as the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and control of Jerusalem. The other set of talks will cover these issues and more limited interim matters. As the talks began, Aaron Miller, a top U.S. mediator, met with the Israeli and Palestinian delegations separately and made arrangements to bring them together later on. September 13th is the target date for a final treaty. With that date fast approaching, American mediators say they'll be more active in these talks than in previous rounds. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
A jury in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, has convicted three men on charges of shipping guns to Northern Ireland. The three men, all Catholics from Northern Ireland, were found guilty of buying guns and ammunition in Florida and mailing them to the British province. The jury acquitted the three on more serious charges of shipping weapons to terrorists and conspiracy to maim or murder persons in a foreign country. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This has been a period of both rejection and success for Amy Mann, a singer-songwriter who was recently described in Rolling Stone as pop's wryest documentarian of love's emotional roller coaster. Let's start with one example of her success, her Academy Award-nominated song, Save Me, from the 1999 film Magnolia.
You look like a perfect fit for a girl in need of a turn.
Amy Mann not only wrote most of the songs for the film Magnolia, the movie was inspired by one of her songs. Nevertheless, she had to bring out her new CD, Bachelor No. 2, on her own record label. The label she had been recording for merged with another label. After the merger, her new CD wasn't considered commercial enough to release. After buying back her master tape from her record company, she planned to release it only on the internet. But with the success of her Magnolia soundtrack, she's also gotten the new CD into stores. The opening track is a song about being misled by a lover or maybe a record company.
I can't do it, I can't conceive. You're everything you're trying to make me believe. Cause this show is too well designed.
Amy Mann, welcome to Fresh Air. Well, you decided to put your CD, Bachelor No. 2, out yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been using, it's available in stores now, but it was initially, I think, only supposed to be available on the internet. Am I right about that?
It was initially offered on the internet, and I sold it at my shows,
mm-hmm.
mainly because, you know, I mean, that's very contrary to, you know, to the sort of traditional record company protocol where you have a release date and it's released in all formats and, you know, you come out with a big splash. But, you know, I sort of felt like it had been a long time since I had a record out. And, you know, this record has been done for, you know, it's basically finished about a year and a half ago. So I just wanted to get it out to my fans as soon as possible. And, you know, and anybody who was interested in searching for it on the internet or anyone who came to a show, I wanted to have that available to them. And, you know, I just thought, well, you know, I'll deal with the rest of it as it comes along.
Now, how did you use the internet, and how much of your music were you offering for free, and how much of it was sales only?
Well, I try to be very circumspect about that. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody's crazy about giving their music away. I think the idea of sort of free downloads or, you know, that kind of thing is, for an artist like me, is especially difficult because it's harder to find my music in really traditional outlets. You know, I mean, it's you're not going to go to Tower and see the big giant display, you know, with a big pile of records and, you know, and be constantly reminded and hear it on the radio. You know, it's not as accessible because there's not the, you know, a large record company presence behind it. So, you know, it's, I think for music like mine, I mean, the internet is sort of where you go to first. And you know, that sort of free download thing kind of really cuts into somebody, you know, cuts into the sales pretty significantly. And, you know, and since I have to finance my own record and I have to finance everything having to do with the record, it's, that can get pretty tricky. I mean, we did some limited, you know, streaming audio and download stuff, but it's kind of hard to know what, you know, if you're promoting yourself or cutting your own throat, really.
Right, when you're giving stuff away for free on the internet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm sure you've seen this as part of Newsweek's June 5th cover story about Napster. There's an illustration headlined, "How Napster Nabs Tunes," and the tune being downloaded in this illustration is your song, "Save Me." The implication is that you'd become something of, like, the queen of the internet.
Well, I don't know what to think about that. I mean, I don't, you know, they wanted me to give a quote for that story, and I still don't really know what to think about it, because I think on the one hand, you know, something like Napster is helpful so people can hear the music before they, you know, before they buy it. But then again, if they don't have to buy it, then they can hear it before they just take it. And you know, I think people have to understand that it's not like the kids against the suits. It's the kids against the artists. You know, I mean, look, are a couple of free downloads going to hurt Britney Spears' business? You know, probably not. But I mean, but that could be all the business that I would get. You know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, how successful have you been on the internet in actually selling your records or using it to promote them or, you know, make people aware of your music?
Well, we've used it. It's kind of random, really. You know, I mean, there's not like really a plan. I think that things come up and it sounds like a good idea. You know, you do some sort of, you know, chats and you know, online chats and you know, a couple of downloads here and there and interviews and online magazines and that kind of thing. And it does kind of accumulate into something. I mean, certainly having the record available for sale on the internet was a really a great thing. I mean, that really kind of jump started stuff for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially because it's only been recently that I signed a distribution deal to get the records into stores, and you know, it's in stores now. But for a long time it wasn't. So yeah, I think it's just helpful to have a place for, you know, sort of diehard fans, you know, people who really care about it to find out where you are.
Nick Hornby, who wrote the novel High Fidelity that the movie was adapted from, has an article about you in The New Yorker, and he wrote, "What have things come to when the ability to purchase a CD over the counter by one of America's sparkiest musical talents is a cause for celebration?" I mean, he was,
yeah,
like shocked, like, oh, we have to celebrate. It should be a big deal that your CD is in a store. That should be obvious.
I know, I'm telling you. Well, but that's, you know, that's the way things are now. You know, that's, I mean, I feel like I've been, you know, that's a real sign of success, you know, that I'm able to get my record into stores. But, you know, I mean, it's you know, the major labels, I mean, you have pretty much a monopoly, and that's the way it's been. And I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of new, I think there's a lot of people who are in my position who are either disgusted with the major label system or have been, you know, kind of squeezed out of the major label system or, you know, ostracized from it or disenfranchised or whatever, and will kind of go the route that I'm going. I mean, I was kind of forced into it. It was never my dream to start a record label, but, you know, I had to get to the point where it was just, you know, it was just unworkable, you know. I mean, it just didn't work for me. So, you know, it was like, well, anything's better than that. And, I mean, it's actually been kind of fun, you know, you sort of learn as you go along and figure stuff out. But yeah, you know, I mean, I have my record in stores, and it's like, you know, like pop the champagne. It's like, you know, I've hit the big time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Mann, and she has a new CD called Bachelor Number 2. Now, some of the songs on the new CD were also included on the soundtrack from the film Magnolia. You wrote all the songs for Magnolia. Paul Thomas Anderson, in his introduction to the book of the screenplay, said this. He said, "I write to music, so I better own up to stealing quite a many lines from Amy Mann, who provides all the songs in the film. The first line of Amy Mann's song, Deathly, goes something like this. Now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing me again? This may sound familiar. You can find it somewhere in the final 30 pages of this script. I heard that line and wrote backwards. This, quote, original screenplay could, for all intents and purposes, be called an adaptation of Amy Mann's songs." So before we talk about this, let's hear the opening of that song, Deathly, that has the line that sparked the film Magnolia.
Now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing each other again? 'Cause I can't afford to climb aboard you. No one's got that much ego to spend.
That's Amy Mann from her CD Bachelor Number 2. And that opening line, now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing me again, is used in the film when the young woman who's been playing her stereo too loud starts dating the cop played by John C. Reilly. Later on, after they've had a date, that's what she says to him. Amy Mann, how did you write that line in the song?
That's kind of what it was, you know, was in my mind. I mean, I was...
It's a strange thing to think of to say to somebody.
Well, I don't think I ever said it, you know. I mean, one of the things about writing songs is you say, you know, you're able to say things that you can't say, you know. I mean, it is a strange thing to say to somebody, but, I mean, I don't know if it's that strange to feel, you know, that's... When I wrote it, I think I had sort of a big crush on somebody, and it's just sort of like, sometimes it's just like too much to take, you know, it's like too much, to, you know, like, oh, don't be nice to me because then I'll really like you, and I just don't want to be, I can't take it right now. So that's sort of the place I was in. I mean, and it's also at the one and the same time about somebody that I was seeing. From their point, you know, from their viewpoint about me, because it was like he was sort of in the same kind of situation.
So how did Paul Thomas Anderson, who made Magnolia, first hear that song?
Well, he was good friends with my husband, who he had asked to do the score for his first movie, Hard Eight, and the score for Boogie Nights. So they were pretty close.
Your husband being Michael Penn.
Michael Penn, yeah. And Paul and I had gotten to be friends also. And, you know, Paul really is a big music fan. He's a big fan of Michael's. And he was, when I started going into the studio, he was very interested in what I was working on and, you know, came by the studio several times. So, you know, so he was kind of in on the music I was recording pretty much right as I was doing. And I think... he got a tape of some songs as they were being finished and was listening to them while he was writing. I think it just obviously kind of got in his head in a certain way, or sort of put him in a particular place, you know, so he could write.
My guest is singer-songwriter Amy Mann. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Amy Mann is my guest. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. So many of your songs are about relationship troubles. Now you're married to Michael Penn, who's also a singer-songwriter. I assume you have a pretty decent relationship.
Yeah.
How is it affecting your songwriting to be in a good relationship when so many of your songs have been about bad relationships?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, the idea of writing about relationships, I mean, I don't really know what else there is. You know, I mean, to me, everything is in terms of relationships. So that's just how I look at it. You know, like even if, you know, you're sort of writing about your car, I mean, it's like how you feel about the car and what the car symbolizes to you and, you know, what meaning the car has for you and how you enjoy your car. You know, so it's, you know, to me, that's a relationship. So that's kind of how I look at it, you know, and I like to write songs that have a couple of levels where you can... You know, it's just like I sort of write about like a specific dynamics and it can be applied to, you know, to whatever. I mean, if I, you know, if I'm sort of in struggles with a record company, I mean, you know, that's where I make my livelihood. And it's, you know, not surprising that, you know, that problems would come up. I mean, you know, everybody who has a boss always has trouble. You know, there's always trouble at work or trouble with a boss or some coworker or something. I mean, to me, that just seems like really... it's like really common themes, and you know. So to me, I don't know. That's like what's interesting in life, or you know, how you feel. You know, like people dealing with each other in various ways, and like the sort of different dynamics, and you know, where people like come head to head. Like, what is that about, and how does that happen, and how can you get out of it, and you know, can it be solved? You know, can people's differences be mediated? You know, I just think that's all really interesting.
I was wondering though if it's easier to write. From a craft point of view, about bad relationships than about good ones.
I don't. Well, I mean, I don't really write so much about good relationships or positive relationships or happy relationships that are working well, because I don't spend a lot of time thinking about why they work well. I think I already, you know, I know what makes a good relationship and what makes a relationship work well, and it's not sort of like something that I pondered. You know what I mean? Like when I write a song, it's because I'm pondering some, you know, some sort of question, or you know, something that really absorbs me, or you know, or maybe it's a, you know, a problem or a difficulty that I'm trying to figure out. But like a good relationship, you don't, you know, or a happy circumstance, I mean, you don't figure it out. There's sort of nothing to figure out. You just have it. You know, you just have it and enjoy it.
You and Michael Penn recently toured together, and the articles about the tour reported that you were both too something to actually talk between songs. So you had comics doing the banter between songs instead of doing it yourself. What were you too what to do it yourself?
Well, I don't know what to what. I mean, I think it's just an idea we had. Michael and I had started playing shows together by playing at a place called Cafe Largo that's owned by a friend of ours. And Largo is very small, and it has a lot of acoustic acts. And the people that go there are sort of very dedicated music lovers who are kind of up for anything. So it's, you know, we could go there and play new songs, or, you know, if you played half a song that you were working on. I mean, you know, people were just kind of interested in that, and it was very sort of loose, and you didn't have to be really professional. So we had played a handful of shows, and then we were talking one night about how, you know, I think we were dissecting a show and saying, you know, like, well, that was a great show, but I just felt like such an idiot. I didn't know what to say to people. And, you know, both of us sort of have that problem where you don't often know what do you say to an audience. Or, you know, sometimes you do, but it's really, you know, I mean, you can't, like, rehearse something and So we both felt sort of awkward, and then we just got the idea, like, well, let's get one of our comedian friends to do the, you know, sort of banter for us between songs. And, you know, he could just come on and speak for, you know, pretend he's us and speak for us. You know, I mean, I'm sure he could do, you know, do it much better than we could. So just as a lark, we started doing that. It was just really, really funny. I mean, it's such a goofy idea, but it turned out to be so funny that we really wanted to keep it in. And then eventually, you know, we just thought, you know, well, we should go on the road. We should take the show on the road.
Your songs are pretty moody. Does it break the mood to have a comic talk in between the songs?
I think it's great. I mean, it's certainly great for us. I think it serves a couple of functions. I mean, first of all, it's very entertaining for us. So it keeps it interesting for us, and it kind of serves like as a, you know, I think that sometimes that our perceived seriousness is sort of off-putting for people, and when they see the comedians and how we sort of interact with the comedians, you know, plus it takes the pressure off us. So I mean, we do talk quite a bit, you know. And it makes it easier for us to talk, but you know, when people see that it's really kind of a lighthearted thing, that I think that they have a deeper understanding of the songs. You know, I mean, my songs might be seen as serious and kind of angry, but I mean, a lot of times I sort of mean them. You know, lines that people think are really like bitter, I mean to be just kind of sarcastic or funny even, and you know, I think that having the comedian around sort of helps to bring that out a little more. And it also, like, I find that people really focus. You know, if you're focusing on a comic who, you know, if you're focusing on his words, that you retain that sort of focus when the music starts, so you really listen to the lyrics. And then it just becomes a more involved and thus enjoyable experience.
Amy Mann will be back in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air.
It's not what you thought. When you first began it, you got what you want. Now you can hardly stand it though, but now you know it's not going to stop. It's not.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House, Inc., Crown Division. Publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London, and Sarum. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, working for 50 years to enhance the quality of life and communities and to support a free press. And from Random House, Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path by Jack Kornfield. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Amy Mann. Also, you used to be able to tell what a corporation did by the name that it had, but not anymore. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the latest corporate trend. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer-songwriter Amy Mann. She wrote and performed most of the songs for the 1999 film Magnolia. Her song Save Me was nominated for an Academy Award. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. You write so much about relationships. I want to ask you about a relationship in your life. I was reading that when you were young, I guess when you were like 3 or 4 or something, your parents divorced. And then shortly after that, you were living with your father, and your mother and her new boyfriend took you, unbeknownst to your father, and moved with you to Europe. And your father searched for you with a private detective for a year. Were you aware of what was going on behind the scenes at the time?
No, I don't think you're ever aware. You know, when you're that young, you're just kind of like, you just don't question it. I mean, you know, so you're not at home, you're in planes, you're, you know, things are happening, you don't, you know, you might not like it, but I just don't think you know, I mean, you're a kid, I mean, you just kind of go along and you know, whatever happens, I mean, that's, you know, that's what's normal because that's what's happening to you.
How old were you when you moved to Europe with your mother?
I think I was 3. I mean, I wouldn't even call it, you know, I don't know if they sort of traveled around or what, you know, what the deal is, and I mean, I'm a little, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the details are. I mean, I think the sort of basic thing was that, you know, I went away and my father didn't know where I was. And, you know, it's sort of one of those divorce situations that, you know, that are pretty common where, you know, just, I don't know, it's kind of a, just becomes a kind of a mess. You know, I mean, I grew up with my father, but I'm on pretty good terms with my mother now, so for that reason I don't really like to talk about it a lot, because, you know, I don't see any point in having her feel like, you know, really weird about it. Plus, I don't sort of know what the details are exactly, so, you know, I don't want anybody to kind of like feel, you know, feel
I understand
bad, bad just, about stuff.
Just wondering though if it affected your sense of what marriage or relationships were like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it affects it. You know, you don't really realize it's affecting it for, you know, for a long time. I mean, yeah, it's you know, I mean, I had like a real, I could sort of call it like a bad attitude. You know, I had a real bad attitude about marriage and what marriage was and you know, I think that there's like a whole host of assumptions, like kind of unconscious assumptions you make about relationships, you know, based on your own experiences. And, you know, I think probably one of mine that, you know, I kind of realized later was that, you know, I just had the assumption that relationships were all like, you know, they were all impermanent, you know, that they would all come to an end. And, you know, that's kind of what you're left with.
How did you decide to get married, given the cynical attitude you had about marriage?
Well, I don't really, you know, it's not like a cynical attitude so much as
skeptical.
You know, like, no, it's like it's dysfunction. You know, I mean, I put it squarely, and you know, it's not like a posture. I mean, I think you sort of realize that you have these beliefs that you don't really know that you have, and you know, I mean. You know, you go to therapy and you figure it out. I mean, I'm a big believer in that. I think, you know, there's like a whole, I don't know, I'm getting extremely inarticulate right now.
Well, therapy, though, is that good for songwriting? You know, to have somebody helping you introspect about your life, pointing things out, was that useful in discovering things for, say, characters to say in a song? Or
I don't know if I put it to use in that way. I just think it's to become more self-aware, to figure stuff out. Personally, I think it's fascinating. I think it's really fun. It's really interesting, and it totally goes along with my interest in, you know, relationships between people and how they interact with each other and, you know, the crazy stuff they get up to. I mean, I just think it's totally fascinating. So it's, you know, so I really love going to therapy, and you know, I think it's been, you know, invaluable, absolutely invaluable. I mean, that there's sort of a tool out there to help people figure out stuff that heretofore you have assumed that was you couldn't figure out, you know, I mean, or that you just assume that something's just wrong with you, you know, that's just the way you are. So, yeah, I think it's a miracle, you know. I recommend it highly to everyone.
In the 80s, you were in the group Till Tuesday, which had a couple of gold records. How would you describe Till Tuesday?
You know, like a real, typical 80s band. You know, we were like the perfect 80s band. You know, it was really like a perfect, perfect grouping of people. You know, it was like the perfect confection for that time.
What was 80s about it?
Well, from my point of view, I had come out of, I'd been in this band that was a three-piece band that was kind of like an art, noise, new wave. And, you know, we sort of had this ethic of, you know, you could never do anything that anybody had ever done before. You know, so if it was, you know, if there was like a chord change, or, you know, if it was melodic anyway, you know, like the chord changes all had to be like very disjointed and dissonant, and you know, you couldn't sort of just lay down like a, you know, like a groove on the drums, you know, where it played two and four. I mean, you couldn't do that, you know. So we had this rule one time where, you know, you couldn't use any cymbals, you know. It was these sort of like arbitrary rules, you know. We were so desperate to sort of be different, you know, and it was fairly unlistenable. but, you know, I mean, really interesting, you know, very creative. And but after a certain time, I sort of started to feel like, you know, well, there's like a certain tyranny here, you know, and also like the lyric writing and the subject matter had to be, you know, arcane in the extreme. And I remember one, you know, a band that we were friends with, they had a song where the lyrics were a recipe for shrimp flambé, you know. So it's like, see, you know, you can't sort of have lyrics that mean anything, or, you know, love songs are right out. And, you know, I started to feel like, you know, that was like the tyranny of the, you know, of the punk movement, where, you know, you know, you'd be really rebellious to write, you know, sort of a melodic love song. And so Till Tuesday for me was like a real rebellion against that. And, you know, and that's how that started for me.
Why don't you choose a song from Till Tuesday to play?
Oh, God. Well, I sort of consider that Till Tuesday, you know, the group Till Tuesday really only existed for one album. You know, for the first record. And, you know, and I would say that Voices Carry is probably the best song on that
record. That was your hit.
Yeah.
Why don't we hear it?
Okay.
That's Amy Mann, recorded in the 80s with the group Till Tuesday. What was your stage persona like when you were with Till Tuesday compared to what it's like now when you're performing on your own?
Well, I'd say in those days, you know, you try to do what you think you're supposed to do. You know, I never felt very comfortable. I don't think I talked between songs at all. I remember the managers we had saying, you know, trying to get, you know, I mean, I'll just say right now that you know, that they were really in no position to sort of offer like advice on aesthetics in any way. But I remember them, you know, saying that, giving me sort of a list of things that they thought I should do, and you know, saying that I should talk more, and they had sort of a list of things I should say, you know, which is sort of like, you know, yeah, this is a good-looking crowd tonight, and you guys ready to rock? You know, stuff like that. And, I mean, I couldn't bring myself to say that. I mean, I had, like, a real distaste for, like, you know, real rock cliches, you know, like performance rock cliches, uh-huh. having sort of come out of the punk world, you know, like I just thought that stuff was embarrassing. So plus I just had, you know, I mean, I just don't have an affinity for that. I mean, I'm not sort of a natural leader who can kind of get people all, you know, clapping together or whatever.
Sometimes that stuff really strikes me as like the rock version of Simon Says.
Absolutely. I know. It's funny. Yeah, it's kids' games. But, you know, so I never really knew what to do. And I mean, I worried about it. I think at one point, you know, it was suggested that we sort of do dance steps. And, you know, because that kind of stuff was really going on. And, you know, I think we probably flirted with some dance, trying to dance on stage a little bit. And God, I just felt like really uncomfortable. I mean, it was really uncomfortable the whole way. And I don't think that I felt comfortable on stage really until, you know, truly comfortable on stage really until I started playing Largo and just played, you know, by myself with acoustic guitar. And that's sort of the only thing that really felt like it made sense to me.
And is that what you're doing now in your performances?
Playing, yeah, pretty much.
With acoustic guitar?
Yeah, I mean, we have a band that, you know, we sort of add people in for various things, but we call it acoustic vaudeville. So, you know, at least half of the set is, you know, we're always playing acoustic guitar, but we sort of add, you know, various instruments in, and it gets bigger, it gets smaller, but you know, but that's always the core of it. It's just us and our guitars.
My guest is singer-songwriter Amy Mann. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Amy Mann. She wrote and performed most of the songs for the 1999 film Magnolia. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. So without being too reductionist, there have been a couple of opposite phases in your music life, one being in a hit pop band and feeling uncomfortable with some of the things you're expected to do on stage, and the other feeling quite comfortable doing your own songs, but also being deemed not commercially viable at the
right.
same time. Although I think you're kind of disproving that. But which is better, having like the bigger success and the more discomfort, or more comfort and less financial success?
Well, I'm really one of those people who literally cannot handle success. I mean, I you know, success as it is. Defined in the music business, you know, first of all, I mean, you're working all the time. You are working all the time. I mean, if people think that that's an easy job, they're crazy. It's impossible. I don't know how people like Britney Spears do it. I mean, I really don't. It is like a Herculean task because you're never home and you are working 24 hours a day. And, you know, and part of your work means to, you know, every person you meet, you sort of have to present this like, you know, larger than life, kind of charming, mythological exterior of, you know, star, you know, the star stuff. It's just crazy. I don't know how people do it. I really don't. It's just a, you know, you have no life. I mean, that's your life. And I think that if you have something in you that like is really, you know, where the love of hundreds is not enough, you know, the love of thousands, it's got to be the love of millions, you know, like it's like there's never enough love, then that kind of helps you keep going. Or, you know, if you got stuff you're running away from, that helps you keep going. Or, you know, I mean, it's like being dysfunctional in a lot of ways really can help with that. But, you know, there's another certain kind of dysfunction that is just like makes it impossible. I mean, you know, I like playing shows, but it's a very controlled atmosphere, and there's always the assumption that people have come to see you are there because they really like you and like what you're doing. But, you know, I don't like people to look at me. I mean, I don't like to have my picture taken. I don't like to be looked at or you know, stared at on the street or followed or, you know, it's creepy. I mean, I just think it's weird and creepy. I don't know how people deal with it. So, you know, so there's that. But also, like, financially, in the major label system, you have to sell so many records to break even that you just don't make money.
And why is that?
And I'm making more money now than I ever have.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you don't have to pay back all the stuff to the record company.
Yeah.
What is paid for out of the money? I mean, why do you have to earn so much before you turn a profit?
Well, it's really, really complicated. It's you know, you get a percentage. I mean, say you get 15%, but there's sort of a list of things in your contract that sort of exempt money from going into that pool of 15%. You know, they deduct for breakage and, you know, packaging, and there's all these things. So it really comes down to, like, I don't know, 7%. But out of that 7%, you have to pay back all the costs of the record. If the record cost, you know, I mean, records today, there's records that cost $500,000. You know, I don't make records like that, but you know, people do. So, you know, you pay back the cost of the record, but out of that 7%. And right. You pay back the cost of the video and tour support and all that. I mean, it just, you know, you can spend $1 million on a record, you know, or promoting a record or tour support. I mean, you can spend anything. You can spend giant amounts of money. But even if it's sort of a modest amount of money, it's you got to sell a lot of records to make that 7% add up to, you know, whatever the cost of the record is.
Has it been a problem or a welcome thing to have to handle some of the business end of your music now?
I just, my attitude is that I just can't, I just could not keep doing that. And whatever, you know, I would just do whatever it took to get out of it. And, you know, so whatever I have to deal with now, at least it's, you know, I mean, there might be headaches now, but at least they're different headaches, you know, it's a new headache. So it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting and fun. It's, you know, it's not sort of, it's not impossible, you know. I mean, I might have small gains, you know, and celebrate the fact that I can get my record in the store. But, you know, but that's very satisfying, you know. Or I might make mistakes, but at least I'm making the mistakes, you know. It's me who made the mistakes. And, you know, I'll suffer the consequences of my mistakes, but I don't have to suffer the consequences of other people's mistakes.
Did you enjoy your night at the Academy Awards? Even though you didn't win, Phil Collins won.
Well, it was surreal. I mean, it was bizarre. I don't know if I could say it was enjoyable because it, you know, you're working. I mean, I played, so for me it's a working night, and just being at those kind of things, it's, you know, I feel like it's business oriented and it's working, and there's, you know, it's, you can't sort of really sit back and enjoy it in that way. So for me, an enjoyable experience is when everything goes smoothly and, you know, the monitors work and the guitar is in tune and you remember all the words, you know, like that's a fun time for me.
So that was good.
Yeah. I thought it was, you know, it was great. I mean, it was interesting. It was fascinating. I had no, you know, I knew that there was no way I was going to win. So I wasn't plagued with that kind of thing.
Did you have a little speech planned just in case?
No.
You were that confident?
No. Yeah, I mean, I sort of knew there's like a category of people that, you know, I mean, that I would have thanked, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, obviously, and sort of people at, you know, people at New Line and my manager and that kind of thing. But, I mean, I didn't sort of have a speech around that.
Well, Amy Mann, it's been a pleasure. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Amy Mann's new CD, Bachelor No. 2, is on her own label, Super Ego Records. Here's a song from it called Susan.
Susan, I can see it now.
Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how corporations are trying to change their image by changing their names. This is Fresh Air. The business pages are full of unfamiliar corporate names these days, and not all of them are startups. More and more corporations are getting themselves linguistic makeovers. Is all of this name changing good for business? Our linguist Jeff Nunberg isn't sure.
When General Electric's legendary CEO Jack Welch retires in a few months, the business press will be full of tributes to the man who took a sleepy electrical products company and turned it into the corporation with the world's largest market value. One thing he probably won't get credit for, though, is for having had the sense not to change the company's name in the process. You can see where this would have been a temptation. After all, light bulbs and appliances are only a small part of the GE business now, which includes everything from financial services to truck leasing to NBC. And it isn't as if Welch has shown exquisite linguistic instincts up and down the line. After all, this is a corporation that labeled its famous quality control program with the name Six Sigma, which sounds like something L. Ron Hubbard would have come up with. But something told Welch to lay off the name General Electric. But for every old economy company that hangs on to its name, like GE or Caterpillar or Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, there seem to be five that are pitching it over the side. Sometimes the changes make sense when there's a merger or when the old name acquires some unfortunate associations. A year after the ValueJet crash that killed 100 people, the company bought a small carrier called AirTrans and painted that name on all their planes. And after Johns Manville paid out a couple of billion dollars to settle asbestos claims in the 80s, they decided to lay low for a while under the name the Schuller Corporation, before going back to Johns Manville about 3 years ago when the dust had cleared. But most of the new corporate names are just an attempt to liven up a tired brand with a little linguistic nip and tuck. And in fact, you see a lot of perfectly healthy companies doing this in the same spirit with which they roll out a new advertising campaign every couple of years. The one thing you can be sure of is that whatever the reason for picking the new corporate name, it will be more fanciful and less descriptive than the old one. This might be simply a consequence of the outsourcing process. When you pay a couple of $100,000 to a corporate identity consultant with a gaggle of linguists and marketing specialists on its staff, you don't expect them to come back with a suggestion that you call yourself U.S. Tanks and Boilers. You want syllables that buzz with the promise of marketing magic. You go from International Harvester to Navistar, Advanced Medical to Alaris, Interregional Financial Group to Intera. The trouble is that these new names can tend to blur, particularly since they give you no sense at all of what a company actually does. Take Agilent, the name that Hewlett-Packard created when it spun off its original core business of making measurement devices and instrumentation. Evidently, the idea was to suggest agility, but that's not a feature you tend to look for in an oscilloscope, more like what you want in a roofer. Mainly, the object seems to have been to come up with one of those trendy adjectival names that end in ent and ant, names like telligent, sapient, viant, navient. There are fashions in these things, the way there are fashions in the names of retail stores. One year, everything's Trouser Shack and Umbrella Shack. The next year, they've all turned into huts. The year after that, they're back as marts. The fact is that for all they talk about brand differentiation, corporate identity consultants are basically herd animals. It seems as if 80% of high-tech startups get their names from the same formula. They take a prefix like digi, inter, or info, tack on a suffix like vision, cast, or web, and throw in a non-conventional spelling or capitalization to show they're not trammeled by the orthographic orthodoxies of the old economy. Not surprisingly, the nondescript conformism of new corporate names has sparked a reaction. The latest fashion among technology startups is for names that have a homespun, funky feel. Red Hat, Red Back, Blue Pumpkin, Tumbleweed, Razorfish. It can be hard to tell the software companies from the microbreweries. You think of a bunch of Gen Xers sitting around in a loft in T-shirts and Converse sneakers, kids who are so ahead of the curve that they can call themselves whatever they damn well please. But like any bandwagon, this one is easy enough for old economy firms to jump onto. Bluelight.com, for example, turns out to be the name the Kmart people picked for their new e-commerce site. Attention, Blue Light shoppers. It doesn't ring right at the moment, but it will in time. It's getting to the point where corporations change their names as readily as they introduce new product brands. And inevitably, the process tends to feed on itself. It's a curious phenomenon of the modern marketplace that the more corporations spend on branding their products or themselves, the more brand loyalty diminishes. Stockholders, employees, consumers, they're all more fickle than they used to be. Only a sap holds on to a position for the long haul. And if the new names don't work out, they're a lot easier to replace than something that's been monogrammed on your table linen for 50 or 100 years. I started to have some hope about a year or two ago when WMX Technologies went back to its old name of Waste Management Incorporated. Now that's a fine, descriptive old economy name. Garbage is us. The only trouble is that the stock is still in the dumps.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown & Company, publisher of Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris, available in bookstores nationwide. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. And from Random House, Inc., Crown Division, publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London and Sarum. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the ups and downs of publishing on the internet. We talk with David Talbot, the founder and editor-in-chief of the pioneering online magazine Salon. Last week, it was one of three online journalism sites that announced layoffs as a result of financial problems. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.